So I'd like to thank the organisers for asking me to take part in this meeting, which is obviously going to be extremely interesting. And I should tell you that what I'm going to say is was prepared jointly with Sunil Qadri and Victoria Braithwaite, who I'm sad to say is, can I do this one, is died in September. So I'm bringing some words from her. In discussion with the organisers, I decided to broaden out my talk a little bit, and the actual this is probably a slightly, thank you. This is a better title for what I'm going to talk about than the one I gave, and that also means that my abstract is slightly obsolete. So I'm just going to go quickly through the points I'm going to cover. I'm going to talk a little bit about definitions of welfare and where emotion comes in, and I'm going to look at some of the many ways we have of studying emotions in non-human animals, using two examples from fish, and one I'll characterize for now as how sea bream respond to food and danger, and then how rainbow trout and actually some other fish respond to harmful stimuli. And having done that, I want to move over to a concept that's increasingly getting an increasingly high profile in welfare discussions, and that's the concept of positive welfare, what it means, and whether it's feasible to protect the positive welfare of captive fish. Before I do that, however, because this is such a diverse audience, as the convener's just pointed out to us, and we've got different, we come from different perspectives, I'm going to tell you where my professional interest in fish welfare comes from. So most of my working life I've worked on fighting in fish, and I've worked in the lab and I've brought fish into the lab and I've put them in tanks in circumstances in which they're likely to fight. And staging fights in the laboratory clearly raises several ethical issues. It's very stressful for the fish, especially the loser. It's very energetically consuming. Sometimes the fish are injured. In my experiments, they've always got somewhere to retreat to, but they might get killed, I suppose. And those clearly that I've had to think about the ethical implications of what I do in the lab. And in the mid-80s, there was a really famous court case in Scotland where a professional research scientist doing publicly funded research was successfully prosecuted for cruelty to animals under a Scottish Act. And the UK Home Office at that point, it was a wake-up call. It decided that they should overhaul the legislation on scientific procedures, which was about 150 years old and only covered physiology. So they updated it and they brought behaviour in as something that must be regulated and also something that you can be protected for doing. And I was one of a number of people who were doing things in their behavioural research that raise ethical issues, who was consulted in the drawing up of that act. And in response to the same court case, the journal Animal Behaviour decided that it should produce guidelines for the use of animals in research, and I was involved in writing the guidelines that relate to aggression and also predator-prey interactions. And the Journal of Fish Biology took over, adopted those guidelines as well, so that when the Fisheries Society of the British Isles in the late 1990s decided that they wanted to commission a briefing paper on fish welfare, they asked me if I would put together a group of people and produce such a document, which I did. And you can see that Victoria and Sunil were part of that consortium. So my interest in fish welfare comes from concerns about the things that I do to fish and not concerns about things that other people do to fish. Oops. And I should also give you another detail from my CV, which is that I come from a family of anglers. I came across this picture recently. This is a typical summer afternoon in the late 60s, by the riverbank, having a picnic. Someone's got a fishing rod and they've caught something, and I'm reading my book. This is my eldest brother. In this picture, he's 18. Here he is again at 78. And for 60 years, he spent most of his spare time occasionally fishing, but protecting a river in the south of England where he
usually fishes, and also teaching kids to fish, but also about freshwater ecology and the importance of protecting the environment. So I'm well aware that responsible recreation, fishers do much more than just catch fish. So that's me, that's where I'm coming from. To get back to the question of welfare and where emotions come in, one comes up, there are a lot of words that come up in this literature. They're all complicated, all controversial, all difficult to define. Emotions, feelings, positive or negative, affect. Because this is a short talk, relatively short talk, I'm not going to spend a long time wrestling with those definitions, and I'm going to try and use just the word emotion. And I've just taken a definition from Wikipedia, actually, and adapted it so you know the kind of things that I'm talking about. We can go into details in discussion later if that seems useful. So emotions, according to this definition, are positive or negative experiences that are associated with a particular pattern of physiological, neurological, and I edited this on a non-British keyboard, neurological and behavioural activity. And when you look at the literature on welfare, it becomes clear that welfare is defined in three broadly distinct ways. Sometimes an animal is said to be enjoying good welfare if its biological systems are functioning properly, if it's free of disease, free of injury, if it's eating and growing well, and if it can cope with the environment that it's in without undue stress. And where emotions come in, the answer here is they don't. We don't need to think about emotions if we use that definition. There's a set of objective parameters, physiological, physical, behavioural parameters that we can measure and use that to identify poor welfare and protect the fish. A very different way of treating welfare, but it's also quite common, is the feeling that in order to enjoy good welfare, a captive animal must be in reasonably natural conditions and able to show its full natural behavioural repertoire. And do we need to think about emotions? At one level, no. You can just go into the wild, classify the behaviour, quantify the behaviour of these animals, and then compare it with what you see in captivity and make sure that they're reasonably similar. But after a while, well, quite soon actually, you begin to find that you do need to think about how animals experience natural events, which is coming on to thinking about emotions. For example, in the case of fighting, it's natural behaviour. Do we need to worry or do we not need to worry if fish in captivity are fighting, or any animal? And the third way of defining welfare is as freedom from negative emotions and having access to positive emotions. And
apparently it's fine, the acoustics are not so good to go all the way to the back, so you could use the microphone.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you. Can you hear me all right? And will you someone jump up and down if I forget? Thank you. Obviously in the case of the third definition, emotions are central to the concept of welfare. Now these are not in conflict. They're different ways of looking at a very complicated phenomenon. And for example, defining welfare in terms of functioning of biological systems has been really, really important in welfare research, including fish welfare research, in identifying poor welfare and trying to correct it. But after a while, and particularly when you get on to talking about positive welfare, you have actually to think about the experience of animals, and we have to try and study the emotions of animals, of non-human animals, objectively. The two complementary approaches here, first of all, you can start from the outside and engineer situations where the animals, by their behavior, will indicate to you what their experiences are. Or we can work from the inside and we can draw deductions from the animal's nervous system about their capacity to feel emotions based on on the physiology of emotions in our own species, or perhaps I should say in mammals generally. And I'm going to give you the two examples. I had to chuck out lots. The two examples that I've left in use both approaches. So the first example, I've called it How Sea Bream Experience Food and Danger, but actually this is the title as the authors presented it. They were interested in taking a model of core human emotions and to see whether it explained the behaviour and physiology of sea breams. So it's an experimental study. The model, as applied to humans, looks like this. Core emotional state in humans is seen as a two-dimensional space. I've drawn it as a quadrat, but of course both axes are continuum. One axis is defined by valence. That is the situation that the person is in generally good or generally bad, positive or negative valence? And the other axis is intensity, how strong is the experience, and salience, how important is it to the animal. And psychologists recognize different emotions they would see in people in each of these four quadrants. The critical point is that people in each quadrant have a different combination of behavior, stress physiology, and activity in subcortical forebrain structures such as the amygdala and the septum. So these researchers set out to see if they could, to see if that tells us anything about sea bream. So juvenile sea bream, they had four fish to a tank, and each tank had a place that the animals could go to take shelter, which I've shown you conceptually here. They manipulated valence in this way. The positive valence was engineered by giving the fish food. And negative valence was engineered by lifting, there was a tray at the bottom of the tank, and they lifted all the fish out into the air for a few seconds. So a brief air exposure, which is dangerous, of course, to fish. And they manipulated salience by making this experience either predictable or non-predictable. So in the predictable condition, for a few minutes before the food or the exposure, a light was turned on and it was kept on through the exposure and during the training period, always before the exposure or the food, a light was turned on. The unpredictable group got the same number of positive and negative experiences and the same number of lights turned on for the same amount of time, but they were random with respect to each other. And the fish had about 2 weeks to get used to this situation. They learned quickly about the light and the predictable situations. And then at the end of that, there were three test periods where each of the four groups and fish in each of the four quadrats were filmed for their behavior. And then at the end of the trial, they were killed to get a blood sample, and they were early expression genes were used to see which parts of their brain were active. And what they found was that the behavior of the animals in the four quadrants was quite different. In the fish, the groups of fish that experienced the positive reinforcer mostly showed social behavior, and the fish that had negative experience mostly showed escape response. This is just to the light being turned on. So they've learned to associate the positive and negative results with the light. In terms of stress physiology, for both predictable and unpredictable conditions, cortisol levels were lower in the food group than in the air exposure group. But in both positive and negative groups, the cortisol levels were higher in the unpredictable situation. So a predictable food is not stressful, but an unpredictable air exposure is particularly stressful. And when they looked at the early expression genes, they found unique patterns of activation in the forebrain, particularly in what are thought to be the evolutionary homologs of the amygdala and the septum. So sea breams conform to the model's predictions in that each combination of valence and salience induces a specific pattern of behavior, stress, and brain activation. And when mammals have been tested in the same setup, that's taken as indicating that they experience emotions. These authors were quite cautious, and they said that they had demonstrated emotion-like states in their fish. So quite a complicated, carefully designed experiment. Manipulating the behavior of fish so they could, as it were, tell us what their experiences are. My second example I'm going to go through in less detail because there's a lot to say, and that is how fish experience harmful nociceptive stimuli. Of course, this is the question of, do fish feel pain? Which I wish it were resolved, but one still finds, there are still areas of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. What I'm going to talk about is beautifully explained in Victoria's book from 2010 on this subject, and also Lynn Snedden in 2015 has written a very comprehensive review of the subject. And they both point out that, of course, there are two aspects to pain. First of all, there's detection of tissue damage and perhaps simple, almost reflexive, protective and avoidance responses. And then there's the negative emotional experience processed by the brain, which is the emotion of pain. Just to deal with the easy bit first, to let you know that in many fish species, sensory structures have been identified that look like and respond like mammalian nociceptors, and harmful stimuli, and traditionally in pain research, bee venom and acetic acid are used, cause immediate reflexive withdrawal, physiological stress, and protective behavior in many species of fish. The difficult question is what it feels like, and I'm just going to run you quickly through something at a behavioral level that indicate that this is a negative emotional experience. So following treatment with acetic acid, rainbow trout show striking suppression of learned feeding responses that last for minutes to hours. In other words, they undergo a motivational shift. These are not reflexes. They're complicated motivational shifts. And the normal neophobic response to a novel object, avoiding a novel object, disappears in fish that have been treated with a nociceptive stimulus. In other words, their attention shifts. And this loss of neophobia is reversed by analgesia. And also, if you look at zebrafish and expose them to acetic acid, a noxious stimulus, you find they'll pay a price, by which I mean they'll leave a weeded tank, which is highly preferred, and move into an empty, brightly lit tank, which is normally avoided, for access to morphine. And fish of several species show long-term avoidance of situations in which noxious stimuli have been experienced. Looking at the other part of that phrase, processed by the brain, I'm telling you what you know already, but fish brains look very different from mammal brains. But there's quite extensive homology between the brains of fish and mammals, both in terms of major brain regions, which are color-coded here, but also in terms that it includes several subcortical structures known to be involved in pain perception in mammals. And gene expression studies in zebrafish show that these homologous subcortical areas are active in fish that are exposed to noxious stimuli. So just to reiterate, we can't say with certainty that fish or any non-human animal experience the emotion of pain in the same way and to the same extent as humans do. We can say of fish that they experience emotions or emotion-like states. Noxious stimuli generate complicated responses that go well beyond a simple reflex. Exposure to noxious stimuli can be strongly aversive, and fish exposed to noxious stimuli seek out analgesia. And that conserved brain regions involved in pain processing in mammals are present in fish, and they're activated in response to tissue damage. I should remind you, the International Society for the Study of Pain have a definition of pain that is an unpleasant sensation and emotional experience linked to tissue damage. And I, in my view, this has been demonstrated from fish. I fear we'll have, in the UK anyway, we're going to have to fight it all over again if Mr. Johnson gets in. So now, the concern, the deep and that appropriate concern that scientists, aquaculturists, fishermen, fishers, regulators have about fish pain is because up until quite recently the imperative in welfare discussions has been to ensure that the animals that we use don't suffer or that suffer as little as possible. Recently, as we're sort of getting on top of that to some extent, and we know
how to assess welfare, what to do to improve welfare, although we're always getting better at it, there is the concept of positive welfare that's increasingly appearing. And one definition of this, it's a complicated thing, is mental and physical states that exceed what is necessary for immediate survival. To give you an insight from human psychology, Spiegelman, who wrote a book called Positive Psychology in 2002, says a life without positive experience is not merely a neutral life, it's a bad life. So up until now, positive welfare in fishes has received relatively little attention, but in this summer, this review came out, and positive welfare for fishes, rationale and areas for future study. I have problems with some aspects of the review, but it's actually very stimulating, and I found it very thought-provoking and interesting. I'm still digesting, so I'm sharing with you my partially digested thoughts. So cautiously grasping the nettle of positive welfare in fish, in this review they present a framework for what motivates actually humans to produce, perform particular actions. And this framework comes from a book by a human psychologist called Harris, called Beyond Pleasure and Pain, How Motivation Works. And I'm going to show you his framework. He's talking about people, but I've said animals. He does talk about mice and birds, not fish. So he says that an animal, a human being, a person, can be driven to take action by various forms of what he calls effectiveness. And he spends a couple of chapters explaining what it means. And I would ask you just now to accept the term, and I'll tell you how I interpret it. So in other words, so his first thing he talks about is value effectiveness. And in other words, according to this, an animal, a person, is motivated to gain beneficial outcomes and avoid detrimental outcomes. In psychological terms, you might say they're pursuing pleasure and pain. In biological terms, you might give examples of gaining food and avoiding being attacked. And I want to give you an example in a minute and discuss this value effectiveness in the context of care of the body surfaces and see if there's anything interesting about positive welfare that could tell us. Now, the title of the book tells you that Harris has written this book and formed this framework because he feels that pleasure and pain don't explain everything. So we're going beyond pleasure and pain, and he says there are other things that motivate people to do what they do, and if you ignore these, you're not going to be able to predict their behavior. So he has something that he calls control effectiveness, and by this he means people will do things in order to be able to exert choices, to have control over their circumstances, or he would say manage their environment. So I want to talk a little bit about that in the context of self-feeding systems. And finally he says that he has a category called truth effectiveness, which means that an animal, a person, is motivated to learn and to know about their environment regardless of particular resources or what is in their environment. So the actual act of learning about your environment and knowing that you know about it is a motivation in itself, regardless of wherever you might find food or whatever. And I want to just talk about this in the context of learning mental maps and also keeping tabs on risk. So that's where I'm going for the last bit of this talk. We know that in birds, for example, care of the body surface is a very strong motivator. And I want to, this is an example of value effectiveness, motivation to gain beneficial and avoid detrimental outcomes, pleasure and pain, if you like. So I want to explore positive welfare in that context, but I want to do it, and I'm going to just remind you, and forgive me if I'm telling you what you know already, about the relationship between Blue Streak cleaner rats and their clients, which is an amazing relationship. It's been hugely studied, mostly from the point of view of the cleaners, and I just have time to tell you a few key things. Obviously, cleaner rats are named because they remove ectoparasites from larger fish, which are called clients, and course, they're used in aquaculture for that purpose, not the tropical ones. The tropical cleaner wrasse live on reefs and they have fixed cleaning stations, and they're visited by clients of many species. Some are regular visitors and some are just passing through. And although they're named after the fact that they pick off ectoparasites, what they really like to do is to bite off and eat scales and mucus, and sometimes they do that. And when they do that, you can tell because the client fish gives a little jump, so it obviously is a cause of discomfort. And for regular clients, but not for passes through, when this happens, the cleaners compensate with, I've tried to find a different word for this, but actually they give them a back massage, and it's the most amazing thing to watch. There's a video on YouTube, so they take a chunk of scales and mucus, the client jumps, and in this case it's a pair cleaning, one of them goes onto the back and rolls down their spine. And it sounds absurd, but they do it, and they do it quite often. So let's have a look at this from the point of view of the client. Clients visit cleaning stations frequently, many times a week. They often travel long distances, kilometres sometimes, so they pay a cost for this interaction. And regular clients have preferred stations, and they locate these using learned mental maps. So they learn the landmarks, and they find their route. They learn the route there, so they can get there quickly. They also learn to avoid cleaners that have bitten them, unless they've been given a back massage when they come back again. And they also learn to avoid cleaners that they've seen biting other clients. And if you bring them into the lab, you'll find that they'll learn a spatial discrimination task for a simulated back massage, and that reduces their stress levels. So there's lots of things here that make me think that this feels good. They pay a cost, and they'll learn a task, and their stress levels go down. So I would suggest that clients are motivated to visit cleaners to remove unpleasant stimuli, but that also for general skin servicing. So perhaps we're looking at positive welfare through value effectiveness. And when I was thinking, is it feasible? Do we just have to hold our hands up in despair and say there's nothing we can do about positive welfare for captive fish? I think that's not necessarily the truth. The case, I think, for example, we could perhaps produce species-specific scratching posts that allow fish to keep their own skin in good shape. And lots of fish you'll have seen, if you keep fish, you'll have seen them. It's usually called playing, but they spend a lot of time in bubbles. It happens that a couple of weeks ago, I was in Gran Canaria visiting a research station where they rear sea bream, and in the tanks of the juvenile bream, because they naturally live in Gran Canaria in really rough water, so the water's always full of bubbles. They provide bubbles for the fish in the holding tanks, but they need to be able to see the fish, so they keep the bubbles just to one part of the tank. And they'd noticed, and they showed us, that the fish continually dot in and out of the bubbles. So if they have bubbles, they use them. So maybe that is improving their positive welfare, or offering them positive welfare. Self-feeding systems, I'm suggesting that perhaps these offer the fish control effectiveness. And we know that demand feeders, whether working on a lever or whether there's some automatic way of telling when the fish are hungry, but demand feeders that allow fish to feed whenever they're hungry are good for welfare. They cut down on aggression. Consequently, they reduce fin damage and they lower stress. But I wonder whether perhaps an additional reason that they work so well is that the fish are free to eat where they choose. Perhaps this is positive welfare through control effectiveness, in Harris's terms. Now, we know that fish, I want to talk about learning mental maps, and I'm trying to work this into the framework of truth effectiveness, the fact that people are highly motivated to learn about their environment and know about their environment. This is also true of fish. Victoria's work particularly has told us this. Many fish learn and continually update mental maps, and they use these to navigate efficiently in their world. A famous example is the frilthing goby, which forms a mental map of its home range at high tide, and if it gets stranded, say right up at the top right-hand corner there, even though they can't see above the surface of the pool, they're stranded in, they're able to jump unerringly all the way to their home pool. So we know this about fish. And I wonder that perhaps, and maybe we'll hear more about this later, but I wonder if perhaps one reason why environmental enrichment reduces stress is that it allows fish to form, it gives them landmarks around which they can form mental maps. So perhaps this is an example of promoting positive welfare through truth effectiveness. And this last slide I've taken in and out because I'm going to go over time, but it's close to my heart. So I want to talk about how animals keep tabs on risk, but I think it's interesting. And this is also an example about truth effectiveness, about motivation to learn and to know about your environment and the things in it. So I want to talk about predator inspection. It's a remarkable behavior, and it staggers me every time I see it, even after all these years, that if you put a little fish like a stickleback in contact with a predatory fish like a pike, hasten to say behind glass, instead of doing what you might expect, which is taking cover or escaping, they sometimes often do the opposite. They actually swim right up to the predator, sometimes on their own, sometimes in groups, with their tail bent and their spines up, ready to flee at the first sign of real danger, but they keep doing it, and it doesn't habituate. The most extraordinary example I've come across is that if you look at fat-haired minnows that are in cover, and you add to their tank the smell of a pike, they come out of cover and into open water in response. So this is amazing. From a functional point of view, this extraordinary behavior allows the prey species to make an accurate assessment of actual risks, which they need because they need to keep themselves safe, of course, but they have to get on with the business of life. So this is it's really important to them for their fitness to make a really accurate assessment when of risk. So I would suggest that in a potentially risky environment, perhaps it feels good to learn for certain what the actual risk is, even if it made the messages you're in real danger, get out of here, through truth effectiveness. Now, it's true, it is the case that cultured fish often experience apparent risk that they don't have the opportunity to assess. They hear noises, whether in a sea cage or in a laboratory tank. They get smells from the injured skin of other fish, or maybe even from the skin of human beings, from amino acids in the skin. Shadows moving overhead, they're continually exposed to stimuli which in nature would indicate that there's danger there, but they don't have the opportunity to assess it. And I wonder whether somewhere down the line, I've taken this out and put it back in again, I wonder whether somewhere down the line, whether we could provide cultured fish, captive fish, with the illusion, who are going to be exposed to cues that suggest danger, we can't prevent that, but perhaps we could provide them with the illusion of inspecting a predator and finding it safe. So that's just a thought. So the motivational scheme, Harris's motivational scheme, that was used in the Positive Welfare Review, I found really stimulating and interesting. And I think what it can do for us is it can provide additional explanations of why existing welfare interventions work. Things like demand feeders, things like environmental enrichment. And it can suggest new approaches to known welfare problems. So somehow managing to find a species-specific scratching post that you could put in a tank or in a sea cage and allow the fish to keep their own skin in good shape. And it can also perhaps identify unsuspected welfare problems and suggest possible solutions, like the pressing need to assess apparent risk. And but mainly what I want to say, that it is feasible to promote positive welfare in captive fish, and if we can do this, it will be to the potential benefit both to the fish and to the humans who keep them. And at that point, I'll thank you for your attention and stop talking.